Welcome to All Things Marine, Hawaii's thought-provoking show dedicated to marine science and ocean conservation. All Things Marine, brought to you by Kosi Island Earth and the University of Hawaii, Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology. And now, here's your host, the marine science gal, Carly Weiner.
Aloha, I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal on this Tuesday, July 18th, and today we are going to be taking a virtual field trip across the U.S. talking to marine scientists about their very unique and amazing ocean research using new technology. From underwater robots to dolphins using iPads, we have it all. With us today is Dr. Diana Reese, Dr. Ken Rubin, and Dr. Brian Glazer. We will first travel to the East Coast to the National Aquarium where Dr. Diana Reese currently resides. Her work as a cognitive psychologist and marine mammal scientist in the Department of Psychology at Hunter College is groundbreaking. She's working on dolphin cognition and communication and is well known across the globe for her unique and important research. I'm honored to welcome Dr. Reese to the show.
Hi, Carly. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much for calling in. We really appreciate it. So you've been doing work for quite some time on dolphins. First, what led you to the subject matter of dolphin cognition and communication?
Well, it's kind of an interesting start. My background was in theater before this. I was actually a set designer, but I always had a deep interest in the oceans and in animal communication and cognition in general. I went back to college to get my PhD, and I remember I wasn't specifically involved in dolphins, but I read an article in the New York Times. It was the Sunday Times, and they were talking about the slaughtering of whales. And I just remember thinking, what a shame we know so little about these big brains. And I thought it would be really important to study them. So that sort of led me into this area of research.
Well, that's quite the jump from set design to marine mammal cognition. So after you were done school, how did you start working on some of the studies that you're so well known for?
Well, when I first got out of college, I was very fortunate to be able to open my own marine mammal laboratory at a place called Marine World Africa USA in Redwood City, California. We let your move slightly north of San Francisco to Vallejo, same place, but we relocated. And it was there that I started work with an underwater keyboard for dolphins. Now, that may seem a bit strange since they're non-handed. Why would they they have pectoral fins on their side of their bodies, even though they have all the digits that we have, you know, in our hands, they have pectoral fins. Yet dolphins are quite manipulative, and I thought these big-brained, highly social mammals might be interesting to study if we gave them choice and control over this keyboard system. To put this in perspective, around this was in the mid-80s. Again, it was right after I got my PhD, and people were starting to try to give other species artificial codes to understand more about their own communication and their intelligence. So there were a number of studies where people taught chimpanzee sign language. Other labs provided chimpanzees with similar keyboards. Irene Pepperberg at Harvard was teaching an African gray parrot vocal communication skills. And I was really intrigued by these studies teaching codes. So I saw this keyboard research as in line with that kind of thinking. I thought we had a lot to learn if we gave them an active part in the experiment.
Now, I mean, it's amazing some of the work that you've done, and to allow dolphins choice with keyboards, that technology has changed with time. And now it seems you've been moving towards less keyboards and more iPads and other types of work. How is this advancing technology shifting what you do and your ability to do dolphin cognition work?
Yeah, so, you know, it's interesting. When we did the original keyboard study that was published in the mid-90s, we talked about the fact that if you gave dolphins a keyboard, it was a very rudimentary keyboard. We could barely do this at the time. It was a 3x3 key matrix, three-dimensional symbols on a submersible keyboard. If the dolphins hit a particular visual form, a fiber optic beam was broken. We used fiber optics because it was safe, and I'm very involved in animal welfare. So we wanted a dolphin-safe keyboard. If they hit a key, a particular visual form, they would hear a computer-generated whistle, something like or and they would get a different object or activity. It was kind of like a big vending machine for dolphins. They would hit a specific key, they'd hear a computer-generated sound, they'd get an object or activity. That was it. They were fed independently. They were always fed. They were never hungry when they used this. And they had toys to play with throughout. Yet the dolphins very quickly started to imitate the sounds they heard on this being generated by the computer. They mimicked them with great fidelity and very quickly. They mimicked parts of the sound first, and then they put the whole sound together. But they did much more. They also started to show that they were making associations between the sounds, the visual forms on the keyboard, and the items they were getting. So very specifically, Delphi, one of our young males, loved to play with balls. If you gave him choices, he would always pick balls from other symbols. So this triangle, no matter where it appeared on the keyboard, and it would be moved from position to position, he couldn't just use a symbol in the upper right-hand corner to get a ball. He had to track the actual form. If he hit the triangle, he would hear, and he would get a ball. He started very quickly to produce himself and then hit the triangle where it was, and then often as he was playing with the ball, he would also whistle the ball sound. And that was very interesting evidence and strong evidence that they had learned these associations without any explicit training by us. It was spontaneous on their own. And it was fascinating because the two young dolphins, we started with them when they were captive born in our facility. They were with their moms, and both young dolphins showed this ability. And they really showed what I call the emergence of self-organized learning. They put it together, and they did something that looked quite similar to these very young stages of language acquisition in children. The question you asked is, how does changing technology help us? At the time, remember, this was mid to late 80s, and we couldn't track or localize who was actually producing the signals. We knew it was the calves, but we couldn't track how they used these signals because they started to use them within their own vocal repertoire. We also just didn't have the wherewithal to expand the system. We were limited to 5 symbols on the board. Now, and for the past 10 years, I've been really interested in using more digital technology. And now we're using, believe it or not, an underwater touchpad for dolphins. It's quite large. It's a 4x8-foot screen that is it's projected on the human side of a dolphin window. And I'm working with my wonderful colleagues at Rockefeller University, Marcelo Magnasco, who's the head of the Laboratory of Integrative Neuroscience. One of his postdoctoral researchers, Anna Hosevar, who actually designed the software and the hardware for this touchscreen, and Sean Woodward, a doctoral student at Rockefeller, who's put together a sound localization system. We're localizing the sound using an array of hydrophones in the dolphin pools here at the National Aquarium. In fact, I'm talking to you from my office overlooking the pools at the National Aquarium right now. So we've installed this, and we've had some very initial results that are quite compelling.
So how is the underwater touchpad, advancing the experiment or the research that you're doing with the dolphins? Is there new symbols or languages, or what are the tasks that the dolphins are asked to do with the touchpad?
Well, what we first wanted to do was give them the sense of interactivity. These dolphins at the National Aquarium have had no interactivity at all in the sense of, you know, any kind of screen or any kind of keyboard. All the dolphins here were born at the aquarium, and this is all new for them. So what happens if you put a touch screen, a large touch screen, in front of a dolphin? Will that even make sense to them? Will they have any idea what's going on? So before we recreated what we did with the keyboard, because ultimately what we want to do is give them a way to obtain different things, ask for different objects, ask for different activities, which I can describe in a little bit. We wanted to give them something simple, so we designed some dolphin-specific apps, dolphin-friendly apps. So, for example, one of the first applications that we exposed them to was sort of a dolphin version of whack-a-mole. We call it whack-a-fish. And they're little sort of angel fish that move animated, that move horizontally across the screen. We can adjust the speeds. And we wanted to see what would happen if we just projected that. And what we found was that one of the youngest dolphins in the pool, Foster, he immediately stopped on a dime when this came on, and he hit every fish with his melon, the sort of bulbous part of their head, with his melon gently, but he touched every fish. Just he looked like a teenager, playing whack-a-mole. And it was quite interesting for us because that really told us a lot about eye-head coordination. These things are moving. So he was actually able to figure out how to come in and hit all of those. The second time he used it, he started using it with his beak. And now we're going to try to start moving further and giving them different kind of applications for interactivity. But we're going to be shortly introducing them to something similar to what we did with the keyboard, where they see a visual form on a sort of a keypad, and if they hit it, they hear a whistle, and they get a particular object or activity. And we want to see how far we can take that. But some of the questions are, will they mimic again? If they do, how will they use these sounds within their own repertoire? Because the last time we did it, the study that we published, we could only talk about mimicry and the productive use of these sounds in their, with objects. But we couldn't understand how it integrated into their own repertoire. We saw these signals within their own sequences, but we couldn't tell who was vocalizing. So we're really hoping now to do a study using a lot of data. It's this big data study where we can record 24 hours, 7 days a week. We can do these studies and really use the technology we have and new algorithms to try to figure out how they're using them. And I hope, and we all hope in my research group, that we're going to take some forward steps in decoding dolphin communication, which is one of our ultimate goals.
That's incredible, and something that I would love to see. I would like to watch a dolphin play whack-a-mole with a touchpad underwater. Right. That sounds incredible.
You have to come. We actually have, we did a little press release, and we show a little video clip of the dolphins doing this.
Amazing. Now, you're not just focusing on this one project. You've been involved in several other types of work and some of the amazing things you've been doing in the field with the RoboDolph project. Tell me a little bit more about RoboDolph.
Well, so the RoboDolph project is pretty exciting for all of us. What we want to do is become invisible and observe dolphins with the least impact possible. When you're out in the water, and again, field work is relatively new for me. Most of my past research has been in more controlled conditions in aquaria. The RoboDolph project is happening now in Belize. It's a field site that we've been working in for quite some time. One of my doctoral students, Eric Ramos, started observing dolphins out there, and we learned that dolphins use a particular kind of signal when they're foraging in these high seagrasses. We're getting ready to submit that paper shortly. But we wanted to be able to see dolphins from a different vantage point, because when we get out there with our boats, the boats make a lot of noise, and it's hard to record them and follow them without having the noisy boat, the boat noise all over our recordings, and then we can be disturbing the dolphins by the boat. They often focus on us. So we've started to use drones in Belize, and we get a very different viewpoint from above, watching these animals interact. It's a very, very different way of watching them, and we're seeing some incredibly interesting patterns of interaction. We also want to be able to record them with hydrophones, underwater microphones, and we can't do that from a drone. So what we've designed, and this has been with the help of the Schmidt Foundation for Innovation, we're very grateful for this funding, we developed this RoboDolph, as we call it, and it's basically two pontoons. It's kind of a water bike. It's two pontoons, and we have electric motors, so they're quiet. And we're going to be putting instrumentation on this. We can control it from several miles away, so it can quietly be moved to where the dolphins are. It can be placed someplace. And then we can record with 360-degree cameras, GoPros, on a ball, on a cube, and also record them. And that, in combination with the drone, will hopefully give us lots of new information about these animals and what's going on socially. Again, this idea of how invisible can we get and kind of, eavesdrop on these animals.
Sure. And I know drones have been increasingly used for field work as non-invasive methods to be able to study marine mammals and other species. Are there any concerns or considerations when using drones around the dolphins that you take, and do they seem to be affected at all by the drone activity overhead?
Yeah, I'm really glad you asked that question, because that's one of the first things we've done, is to see if there's if it causes any kind of disturbance or change in their behavior. So our first project was to look at their behavior when we're flying these drones in at different heights. And we've seen for the bottlenose dolphins, that's the species we've primarily been observing in Belize, we see very little disturbance. Across hours and hours of observations, we've only had a handful of times, and it's generally when there's one solitary animal where they'll look up or roll over and look up, because they have they can see if they're sort of on their back, they can look up.
Sure.
And we've seen a few of those, but it's with solitary animals, and then they go about their business. There's one particular animal that seems interested in the drone. So we know, go higher than that. And we're really hoping to do some of this very basic work, so we know the heights, the angles at which to come in. We've just done some sound recordings at different heights as well. And there's some other groups who have been working in this area as well. On the other hand, the manatees in Belize seem much more affected. This is not these are not animals we've been focusing on, but we've had opportunistic chances. And often we'll see a manatee mom and her calf, and they seem to really be more disturbed. So we're just getting to, we're just working on actually a publication about this.
Amazing. Well, it's great that that's being considered and looked at when working with these technologies. So both the captive studies and the field work that you're doing, how has the technology allowed you to better understand these animals more than you could do, let's say, 20 years ago?
I mean, it's funny because, you know, they're so different from us, obviously. We've been separated for 95 million years, you know, the cetacean line from primates. Yet there's things about them that are so intriguing. There are interesting similarities. I'm going to jump to a simple approach that we've used that's not technological at all, and then I'm going to go back to technology. So several years ago, my colleague Lori Marino and I did a study at my lab at the New York Aquarium, and this was, we looked at mirror self-recognition in dolphins. It's not technological at all. You use a simple mirror, and you ask the question, if you expose a dolphin to a mirror, how will they react? Now, at the time we did this study, we knew that obviously humans show mirror self-recognition from about 18 months to 24 months of age. Chimpanzees have been tested as well, and they show this at a later age, a bit later than humans, a good deal later than humans. But we're not alone in this capacity. And I was really intrigued about dolphins. Like us, like chimps, they're highly social, they've got large brains. What would dolphins do? And we found that two male bottlenose dolphins at the New York Aquarium showed striking similar behaviors to what we see exhibited by both humans and primates. And humans and other primates. We're primates, so it's humans and other primates. They're interested in looking inside their mouths, looking closely at their eyes, looking at body parts they can't see. So that was really a huge jump for us in discovering these similarities. And we talked about this as convergent cognition or cognitive convergence. And that was with a very simple tool. So you don't have to get too technological all the time to find out a great deal about their intelligence. However, with interactivity with a system like the keyboard, we were very limited. Again, we had fiber optics that were our switching devices. I used an Apple II computer. That's how long ago it was. And we simply couldn't deal with a lot of acoustic data at the time, and we couldn't track the animals. Now we have this technology. We're actually using optical signals, optical sensors, rather, to track where the dolphin is touching on the touch screen. So imagine a 4x8 foot screen in front of you that the dolphin is seeing. Anything that we can project on our computer, we can project in great, in high resolution in the dolphin pool on this large screen. And when the dolphin approaches the screen, it just has to gently touch it, and it's the place that it's touched is picked up by an optical sensor and it's recorded. So this is a different type of software we're using for this, that we've created for this system. Then it all gets logged in and we can track all of their behavior. We also have put in cameras on looking down at the dolphin pools. So right now, for example, I'm looking at a monitor as I'm looking at their pool, and I can see the dolphins from above and see where they all are. We also have side cameras looking into the pool so we can see where they are, you know, horizontally. And then we have hydrophone arrays, four different panels, each with four hydrophones. And we're testing this, our ability now to localize sound. So that's the kind of video audio tracking system that we're working on. So hopefully we'll really be able to look at lots of data and try to understand more about these patterns that we're seeing.
Well, we're excited to follow your journey and see what you learn. So real quickly, before we go to commercial break, what's next for you? And will you be taking the RoboDolph out again? And where do you go from here?
So right now, we're focusing on the touchpad at the National Aquarium. We did the maiden voyage of the RoboDolph several months ago. We're putting more instrumentation on it now, and then we hope to go back a little bit later in the fall for our next trip in Belize. By the way, we're also in Bimini watching wild dolphins, and Marcelo and Anna, my colleagues, and a few of our students are going to be going out. We've been studying wild bottlenose and spotted dolphins in Bimini, and we're about to embark on another trip. We're looking at bow riding and how these magnificent animals are interacting on the bow. It's a very defined context, and we're doing audio and video recordings, again, using 360 recordings of GoPros as well as hydrophones. So that's that, and we've been doing this for the past seasons.
Well, never a boring day in the dolphin world, that's
no,
for
it's
sure.
It's a lot of work. It sounds like fun, and it is fun, but it's also a lot of work. So.
Absolutely. Well, your studies have been absolutely groundbreaking and so interesting to follow. Thank you so much for taking some time to speak with us. We will take a quick commercial break, and when we come back, we will be exploring technologies in the deeper parts of oceans.
You know, we can do anything. We're smart and strong. The last thing we need is something to slow us down. So here's something everyone should know. UV rays from the sun can hurt your skin. Even a few serious sunburns can increase your chances of getting skin cancer. So choose your cover. Use sunscreen with at least SPF 15 with UVA and UVB protection. Cover up with clothing or find some shade. As long as we protect our skin from the sun, we can keep reaching for the stars.
Brought to you by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Which do you think is riskier for your pet? Scuba diving or squirrel chasing? Twists and turns or fleas and ticks? Turns out everyday dangers make being a pet risky business. But a risk assessment and wellness exam from a veterinarian twice a year can reduce disease risks and prevent problems before they become serious. Contact your veterinarian today because being a pet is risky business. A message from the American Veterinary Medical Association.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, I'm Carly Weiner, the Marine Science Gal, and today we are talking about changing technology in ocean science research. With us now is Dr. Ken Rubin, Professor and Department Chair for Volcanology, Geochemistry, and Petrology at the University of Hawaii, Manoa. Dr. Rubin will be going out later this summer on Schmidt Ocean Institute's research vessel Falkor to explore sea level rise using ancient coral reefs. Welcome to the program.
Aloha.
Thanks so much, Dr. Rubin, for making some time to speak with us today. So before we get, you know, into the technology part, tell me a little bit about your plans for the upcoming expedition and what interests you in ancient sea level.
So our work that's coming up on the research vessel Falkor, which is being supported by Schmidt Ocean Institute, includes going out and studying coral reefs that were formed during the last ice age. And you might say, why do we care about that? Well, it turns out that at the peak of the last ice age, about 20,000 years ago, sea level was 350 to 400 feet deeper than it is today. In Hawaii locally, it may have been as much as 450 feet deeper. And it rose over the following 10 to 12,000 years. And that tracking that change, not only in Hawaii, but in other places, tells us a lot about how sea level rise is impacted by a variety of local factors. And this is what we use to reconstruct our predictions for future change. So what we're going to be doing is developing as complete as possible virtual 3D reconstruction of a drowned coral reef and tracking how it changed in time as sea level rose over that 10,000-year period, looking at everything from the age of different corals at different times so we can track how sea level moved, what types of corals we see, what the community structure is like, meaning what corals live where and when. And this involves using an autonomous underwater vehicle, which is a pre-programmed robot that drives around and does a combination of sonar mapping and photography, and then using the remotely operated vehicle Sebastian, which is Schmidt's relatively new tethered submersible, and we'll be interacting with the seafloor in real time using that vehicle.
So for those of us that aren't intimately familiar with underwater robotic vehicles and how corals can tell us more about sea level, walk us through how does a coral tell us about this ancient sea level and how can we get future predictions out of these quote-unquote drowned corals?
So probably the best way to make an analogy that people might be able to relate to is to think about if you've ever gone out snorkeling or scuba diving. And as you move out from the coast into deeper water, you will see different types of coral colonies. You may not know that they're different species. Sometimes they are. Sometimes they're just what we call different morphologies, different shapes of the coral colonies, which has to do with things like where they're growing relative to what we call the wave base or the area where there's a lot of disruption in the water due to waves passing by, things like local sediment input, the types of nutrients that are provided to the algae that live in the corals. And so using what we call analog sites, and we have analog sites in Molokai, we can look at what corals are currently living at different depths relative to sea level today. And we can find indicator species or indicator assemblages, meaning we find a couple of different species living together in a specific depth range. And when we find those in a drowned reef, we can give an ancient sea level point to it. And then we can date the coral skeletons. They're, of course, dead when they have been drowned. And we can say that sea level was at a certain point at a certain time in the past.
So kind of like how people count rings on trees, we can understand the age of corals based on their skeletons.
That's right. We can. We do that determination with very high precision using a radiometric approach, using the isotopes of the elements of uranium and thorium. We do those in my lab at the University of Hawaii.
And what's always really cool to me is as these robotic dives happen to look at the coral reefs, they get live streamed in real time so people can watch what's happening. What are you looking for? Because it's kind of like a point of discovery for you, too. You're not knowing what to expect. What do you look for, and when do you decide to take a sample?
So one of the primary target areas that we're going to be working on with a robotic vehicle is a place called Penguin Bank. It's just off of the island of Molokai. And this is a place we've been working for the last decade or so using manned submersible dives, the Pisces submarines of the Hawaii Undersea Research Lab. And so we have a kind of a good idea of individual spots, what we see in one place or another place, but we don't have a holistic understanding of the entire reef. And that's part of what the building of the sort of virtual world that we will do using the robotic vehicle, the autonomous underwater vehicle, we'll build up an entire reconstruction of a swath of reef that's about 10 miles long and about a mile in the perpendicular direction, and at the level of being able to see things that are certainly the size of a coffee cup or a Coke can, maybe as small as a fork, And then by having that full reconstruction that we can interact with, and then coupling that, we'll collect that data first, and then we'll put the robotic vehicle in the water, and combining that with our previous observations, it will allow us to pick target sites that we want to go and study in lots of detail. Yeah.
So is there anything that if you see during the dives that you'll get really excited about and be like, that's what I've been looking for?
So there are several things that we're already aware of. It turns out that during that period of time, sea level didn't rise at a constant rate. There were a couple of periods of time where it rose at very accelerated rates. We call these meltwater pulses, and these are very significant for our understanding today because we believe they come from short-term instabilities where something changes very rapidly. Everyone is perhaps aware that there's a large chunk of sea ice in the southern hemisphere that's about to break off of Antarctica. These kinds of events sometimes, we believe, can lead to very rapid sea level change over as short a period as 100 years. So we have a couple of target depths where we believe the largest of these events, called Meltwater Pulse 1A, when it happened, we have some idea of what the coral colonies look like during that period of time. And so if we find these things in the places that we predict, that will be very exciting, and we'll want to study them in a lot of detail.
Sure. Well, maybe you can come up with a more creative name than Meltwater Pulse A. So we hear a lot about sea level rise here in Hawaii, especially recently with all the King Tides press that has been coming out. But will this research help with future predictions here locally? And what can this work tell us about future sea level rise?
So it turns out that pretty much everything we know in the climate realm in terms of predictions for the future, and this includes sea level, but not only that, comes from our observations of the past. And this is because the extent of change that we expect to happen from human-induced climate change over the next several hundred years are beyond the range of things that we've observed through the period of human history where we've been able to make observations. So it also turns out that sea level is a very complicated thing. All the way up through the 90s, we used to think about sea levels as sort of like a bathtub. You get in and it rises sort of consistently everywhere. But now we understand that for a variety of reasons, it doesn't do that. And these reasons have to do with sort of where and how ice melts from the ice sheets and how that affects, they have a gravitational attraction and the land underneath them rebounds. And this all happens at different rates in different places. And so Hawaii ends up being one of these places in the world, very few of them, where most of those effects don't happen. And so by studying sea level change here, we can get a baseline. Most of the places where people have studied sea level reconstructions in the past, which are directly used to understand future sea level, have been at places that we describe them as being contaminated by these other effects, so that we are making bad predictions on the basis of places that had complicated interactions that make the sea level signal not easy to understand. So coming here to Hawaii and doing it in this place is very, very far from the continents, very far from the ice melt sources, should give us a purer signal. And one of the things that we already know is that, for instance, the global ocean appears to have been deeper than the sort of generally accepted value based on where we find corals that were growing during the last ice age. They're too deep to have had a sea level that was only about 350 feet deep. We find them at about 450 feet deep, which tells us that we have to revise things like how much ice was formed during the last ice age, and therefore how much water was taken out of the oceans.
Wow. Well, that's a lot of information that you'll be able to glean from, hopefully, this expedition. How reliant is your research on the technology, and how is the technology really helping us to answer some of these lingering questions?
So there's sort of technology at every stage. At the fieldwork stage, the depths that these drowned coral reefs are in are too deep to address with scuba, so we have to use a remotely operated vehicle. Ironically enough, most work with remotely operated vehicles happens much more deep in the oceans, though. And so we'll be using it in what we would consider to be relatively shallow water, sort of 300 to 600 feet deep, which itself will be a major challenge, sure. Interacting with the currents and everything, and using the vehicles to completely document everything that we see in a geospatial reference frame, which means, in the simplest sense, a very, very high precision latitudes and longitudes. And like I say, recreating a virtual world with the seafloor topography that we can interact with subsequently in the lab to hang all of our observations on. So that's one way that technology is involved. Another way is, of course, all the post-processing that happens with the coral samples when they come back to the university. The dating work involves plasma and thermal ionization mass spectrometers and a fair amount of detailed chemistry. And then the final stage is the modeling. And this is something that we don't do, but there are experts elsewhere. We have a colleague at Harvard named Jerry Mitrovica. And they develop these very, very complex models that take into account all the various things that can happen as sea level changes and ice melts, and use them to sort of take our results and model them in the context of the rest of the world and help to understand how sea level change might vary from place to place, both in the past and projecting forward into the future.
And this is not going to be your only expedition on Falkor. You have signed up for two cruises this year, very different research purposes. Tell me a little bit more about the second cruise that will take place in November, December.
Yes, sure. So the second cruise has to do with submarine volcanoes. And I often get asked sort of, Ken, why do you work on volcanoes and coral reefs? They seem like very different things. And what I tell people about is that since I was a very young kid, I was always interested in volcanoes scientifically, but I've always been in love with the ocean. And when I first came to Hawaii in 1992, I got introduced to sea level problems, and that's why I've been working on them. But my first love are submarine volcanoes. And the project that we have going in the autumn is to a place that has arguably the largest number of distinct and active or recently active submarine volcanoes that we know of on the planet. It's in the waters of the country of Tonga, which is, for those of you who know your geography, it's north of New Zealand and east of Fiji and south of Samoa. And this includes a place called West Mata Volcano, which I and a group of other scientists observed to be erupting in 2009. So we're going back to these places and observing how they've changed. And the key part about that study that we're hoping to learn is something about how do the combination of the rate of growth and geological phenomena at a whole bunch of different volcanoes impact the submarine ecosystems, the organisms that live at those volcanoes, and especially at the hydrothermal vents that have developed on them. And we see lots of differences between those sites, but we haven't yet developed a framework for understanding is there a sequence of events, or is it sort of random that causes us to have different organisms at different places? So that's the primary goal there.
Excellent. And will the technology that you're using on that cruise be similar to the one you're using on the sea level cruise, or how will the utilization of the instruments be different?
So at one level, it'll be the same. We'll have an autonomous robot, and we'll also have the ROV. We'll be doing additional things, such as mapping in the water above the volcanoes for looking at the chemical outputs from the volcanic plumes. We'll be bringing listening devices called hydrophones, which were mentioned in the last segment, and we use those to listen to potential, eruption events or water as it exits these hydrothermal vents. That can be used in different ways, but to a first order, we'll be using similar technology in similar ways. We'll just be applying it to a very different set of problems.
Excellent. And so these are very different projects that you're working on, but I'm sure they're not the only projects. What else keeps you busy during the rest of the year?
So, as I say, volcanoes are my first love, and I have ongoing work as well in Iceland. I also am involved in something called EarthCube, which is a National Science Foundation effort to develop cyber infrastructure, which is computer-based solutions for the earth sciences. And this includes everything from discovery, manipulation, visualization of data resources. And the idea with this effort is to A, democratize science, B, make data available to everyone, and C, especially to make data available to non-experts in a way that they can use it intellectually, rather than interacting with it in a blind way. And so that requires a lot of development of standardization and shared vocabularies and this sort of thing. And so that's been one of my passions for the last several years.
Excellent. Well, I'm glad you brought up the democratization of science, because we're going to be talking to Brian next, and he has a really interesting project. But I really do believe in that open sharing of information. And I know, too, that the data that will be collected on both those expeditions on Falkor are made publicly available, as well as the dives are live streamed. Now, this information that you guys are collecting on the cruise and the plans for the cruises will also be available through community presentations and outreach. And I know there's quite an extensive list of ways that the public can interact and learn a little bit more. Why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah, I'm very excited about that. And, one of the things that we'll be doing on both of the expeditions is streaming the observations that are coming from the remotely operated vehicle during the day. There'll be a period of time during the day where we'll have active narration for the public, and we'll be able to take questions and answers. And I hope people do engage, if for no other reason, to just see what it looks like down there. It's a whole different world, and it's fascinating to realize that parts of our planet can look so different and yet still be here on Earth. There's also a series of public events I'm going to be participating in. I know there's something at the Waikiki Aquarium on August 22nd in the afternoon. I'll be talking in general about Hawaiian coral reefs and sea level change. And Carly, I know you also arranged for events speaking in Hanauma Bay and live streaming at the Bishop Museum during the Hawaii expedition. So I think those are ways that people could interact.
Absolutely. And there are also weekly video blogs and online daily written blogs where people can follow along. Ken, I'm really looking forward to the upcoming ancient sea level cruise and to see a little bit about what Hawaii's reefs can tell us about sea level. Thank you so much for taking some time to be with us today.
Thank you.
We're going to take a quick commercial break, and hang tight when we get back. More technology with Dr. Brian Glazer.
In a minute, I'm going to drown in this pool, surrounded by friends and relatives. That's because Dad thinks Mom is watching me, and Mom thinks Dad is. But actually, nobody is watching me. And you rarely make a sound when you're struggling the moment.
Don't assume someone else is watching. Become a water watchdog at abbeyshope.org.
You mean I could have diabetes and not even know it?
Then why would I want to know?
Heart disease, amputations, stroke, blindness can all be caused by diabetes. So it's critical that you know. If you're over 45, you don't exercise, and you're overweight, you're at risk. But a simple blood test can detect the problem, and with early treatment, you can prevent the devastating effects of diabetes. Call the American Diabetes Association at 1-800-DIABETES. Don't be blind to diabetes.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal, and today we are talking about technology and ocean research. With us now, we have a returning guest to our show, Dr. Brian Glazer, Associate Professor of Oceanography at the University of Hawaii, Manoa. It's so nice to have you back.
Aloha. Thank you.
Thank you. So last we had you on the show, we were talking about your work at Lauihi Seamount, and most of your research focuses on the deeper ocean environments. But recently, you've embarked on a new project, one that's been funded by NSF. First of all, congratulations, and tell us all about it.
Thanks. Yeah, so I do kind of a blend of aquatic chemistry and microbiology, and the fun part about that is that we can do that anywhere there's water. And so sometimes we get to use exotic vessels and submersibles and go to Lauihi and look at underwater volcanoes. Other times we can go into the basement and find a rusty pipe, but understand that same kind of chemical process, redox biogeochemistry. And I've always had local coastal projects. In 2014, I had 3 months of big global sea time projects, and it was too much travel. My wife and I were about to have our second child, And so in 2015, I started focusing a little bit more on local coastal projects. I've worked almost continuously in Kaneohe Bay at Heia Fish Pond over the years. And so over the last 2 years, we've really expanded that effort with some federal funding as well as some matching resources from Schmidt Foundation as well. And it's been a lot of fun. We can study some of the same kind of process-driven chemistry and biological interactions, but on different scales. And instead of needing a ship to go do it or pack up a 20-foot container and worry about shipping logistics, we can hop in a car and run over the hill and get samples right away.
Sounds like a quicker process to me.
It is.
So tell me more a little bit about this project and a little bit about the data logger and what gave you the idea for it.
Yeah, so typically what we'll do in the marine science environment is go out and collect a sample and bring that back to the laboratory, and some number of hours or days or weeks later, we'll measure it, whatever parameters we're interested in, and we'll get some data out of that. And over the course of my career, what I've always done is worked with closely with engineers to either measure new types of chemistry in situ, where we can actually push a button and get a measurement in real time in the field, or make things cheaper so that we can measure something in greater numbers or really tackle spatial variability questions. A term I like to use a lot is called biologically relevant spatial scales. And if you only have X amount of dollars and you can only afford one large instrument that measures a bunch of different things, then you might not really understand the entire watershed, even if it's only several hundred acres, or if it's a larger watershed, like, say, Kaneohe Bay, or larger gradients around the island. And so what I've been wanting to do over the last 2 years is take advantage of some of the technological advancements that have been made by Apple and Google and Amazon in smartphone industry and lowering the costs of electronics that are accessible to us, and use that from a research scientific standpoint to actually put new instruments out in the water at higher spatial resolutions and measure some new things at higher spatial variability.
Makes sense to me. We have dolphins using iPads and iPhones measuring water chemistry. It's perfect. So these data loggers, or what are you calling? Do you have a name for them?
We do. We call them mini nodes.
Okay, mini nodes. All right. So the mini nodes, you know, they're collecting this water chemistry in a way that's more accessible. What kind of things are you learning from the mini nodes, and how do they help people better understand their environment?
Yeah, it's a really open question. It's a fun one to tackle, actually. Typically, what a researcher like me would do is get a federal funding grant and then spend $10,000 to $20,000 on an instrument package that's commercially available. It measures research grade, really, really highly accurate and precise measurements for things like salinity through conductivity, pH, oxidation reduction potential, dissolved oxygen, all of these parameters that really tell us how the environment works. But again, you can only afford so many of those. So what I wanted to do was really drill down, and for the parameters that we need that level of accuracy for research-grade sensors, just spend the money on the sensor itself and then build the rest of the electronic infrastructure around it at much lower costs. So, for example, a lot of listeners may have heard of something called a Raspberry Pi. This is a little tiny pocket computer. It costs $35, and it runs an entire version of Linux. And so I'm not a programmer or an engineer, but I've worked with them and I can dabble a little bit. And I have several old instruments that are great quality for, say, dissolved oxygen in the lab that aren't put to use right now because they were for other projects. So I'm looking at these $5,000 oxygen optodes and I'm looking at this $35 little single board computer and saying, these must be able to work together somehow to enable a low cost wireless telemeter data feed in a place like Heia Fish Pond, which doesn't necessarily have financial resources to enable it, but can benefit from the dissolved oxygen data to understand something about how the pond works today, how the fish may or may not be stressed at different times of the year. And so by piecing these different pieces together, very, very low-cost components for some capabilities that are, say, logging data or transmitting data, but then keeping very high-grade, research-grade sensors in the water to collect robust, high-integrity data allows us to really get a lot more bang for the buck in terms of putting instruments in the water.
I love it. A low-cost smorgasbord of oceanography.
Exactly.
And so why is it important to make these products inexpensive or accessible?
Yeah, so it's an access to really unprecedented spatial and temporal scales. And so at the federal level, there are some pretty large initiatives like the Ocean Observing Initiative. This has been a 10-year, $300 million installation of various different kinds of oceanographic equipment globally. And even researchers who are familiar with this kind of technology still, you know, researchers and postdocs and students may or may not be familiar with how to use them. For a lot of researchers, as well as the public and K through 12 audiences, the kinds of technology that we're using in the oceans is as foreign as Mars rover technology, and it doesn't need to be anymore. Mm-hmm. There are very inexpensive entry points that we can teach even seventh graders to go out and use very low-cost sensors to measure dissolved oxygen and pH and conductivity and understand something about temporal and spatial variability in the coastal zone. And then there are mid-range costs that we can build automated unattended nodes and actually collect time series data. And so to make things inexpensive gives us two different angles. One is bringing data to populations and groups that would otherwise never have access to this firsthand sure. data. And then the other is to provide researchers like me with high spatial resolution to start to understand processes at unprecedented spatial scales.
It's a win-win for everybody. And I can only imagine that you must get students in grade 7 and 8 that have access to this that just love being able to do real-time field work.
We do. We work closely with some a couple of different school groups that visit Hei'ea Fish Pond. And once or twice a year, the one group of students will do an overnighter at the pond. They'll camp there. And so frequently through the year, we'll go out and we'll measure something at noon on a sunny day, and the water temperature is high and dissolved oxygen is high because the sunlight is shining and plants, plankton in the water are photosynthesizing. And I'll ask them, I'll say, well, what do you think happens at night? What about oxygen? And I'll tell them. But then when they're there camping and they make them wake up at midnight and go out and take the same measurement, and they see that oxygen's low at night because the sun is off, photosynthesis is off, but everything that's alive in the pond is breathing and drawing down that oxygen, it really clicks and they understand the process more.
That's incredible. And the data that's collected, is it wireless or open access, or you know, can people that are not involved get that access to the information?
It is. Since we've been funded by NSF and since we've been really fundamentally based upon this open access idea, all of the data is literally downloadable with one click from my website. It's not necessarily very usable yet, since it's an N of about 5 people who are sure. actually using it and familiarizing with it. But we're getting there, and we're moving in the direction to try to make the data more usable to those audiences, in addition to just researchers and students who are looking at it from a very scientific aspect.
Excellent. And you've talked about the fish pond a lot, and it's so nice to see some local applications. Are there plans to create other versions or expand it outside of Oahu or outside of the state of Hawaii?
There are. And so the nice thing about Hei'ea Fish Pond is that it has a very active group of a nonprofit organization, Paipaio Hei'ea. We've worked with them for about 10 years now on small scales, different projects one at a time. It's a wonderful, elegant example of cultural and environmental resilience and restoration in a local coastal watershed. It's a great natural laboratory to really understand and constrain process-driven events that happen in the pond. It's a great training grounds for students, and it also is a great network statewide. There are Paipai is probably one of the best examples that we have today of a restored near functional fish pond, but there are 38 other groups like Paipai statewide. This summer, we've received a $50,000 grant from National Science Foundation to put on a workshop next month, August 7th, 8th, and 9th. We'll be working in partnership with Kua Foundation and Kamehameha Schools and Paipai Ohea to actually bring, we've invited over 28 different Lokoia pond groups, 67 different invitations have gone out, and so we'll bring them out and show them exactly what we've done in Hei'ea Fish Pond and then port some of that out to 6 different islands.
That's incredible. I'm so excited to hear that that work is being expanded. So real quickly before we wrap up, sticking with the technology theme, how is the technology helping you to democratize science or making your work more available to the public?
Yeah, it's great. We can literally afford to give seventh graders access to tools that we couldn't afford to do before. I would never give an undergrad even access to a $15,000 research grade instrument without a lot of training and over the shoulder watching. But if the entire package only costs $100, we can afford to allow them to play with it. And if they mess it up, it's not a huge cost. And likewise for us, being able to afford to put a lot of these out give us access to spatial data that was unprecedented before. And so if I can just take another 30 seconds, I can give a quick example of this. Some of the questions that have been asked this summer are in relation to king tides, which we touched on earlier in the show. So why is my road flooding now, or why is my yard flooding now, and it didn't 5 years ago? And what NOAA and NASA and other large agencies do really well on broad basin scales or huge scales are predict and watch movements on large scales. But people want to know what's happening in their yard, but can't necessarily afford a water level sensor. Now they can.
That's incredible. Well, I'm really excited. Where can people go if they want to learn more or see about getting one of those sensors?
Yeah, from my home site, you can Google me, Brian Glazer, Hawaii, and you can find a couple of different links.
Excellent. Brian, thank you so much. And thank you to all our guests today who have been able to share the technology and how it is making remarkable strides in ocean sciences. I'm Carly Weiner. Now get out there and enjoy our ocean planet.